Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the most expensive congressional race in the nation's history in Georgia, where the polls closed an hour ago, and speak with Andra Gillespie, a professor of political science at Emory University, who served as a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in political science at MIT and was an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman. She joins us to discuss this tight race between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican Karen Handel that has been flooded with outside money since it is widely seen as an early referendum on the troubled Trump administration. We'll look into whether Ossoff can squeak by with a narrow victory, this time with the help of the African-American vote, the absence of which some analysts say cost Ossoff an outright win in the primary, in which he fell just short of the 50% threshold. Then, following the shootdown of two Iranian drones and a Syrian fighter bomber by U.S.-led coalition forces in Syria, we will assess the warning from the Russians that any coalition aircraft venturing west of the Euphrates will be painted by Russian radar and treated as targets. An expert on Syria, Nicholas Harris, a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security, joins us to discuss how Syria and Iran are trying to capture territory in the east of Syria, attempting to fill the vacuum as the Islamic State is defeated in the hope that they can create a land corridor from Assad-controlled territory across Iraq to Iran. Then finally, we will speak with Jonathan Marshall, an award-winning journalist and researcher who has a five-part series of articles on foreign lobbying at Consortium News, the latest of which is Saudis Win Hearts by Lining Pockets. We will discuss how other nations apart from Russia interfere in our elections by pouring money into hiring lobbyists and former officials while funding think tanks and political issues using the dark money channels opened up by the Supreme Court's Citizen United decision. And joining us now is Andra Gillespie, a professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman. She's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America, and served as a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andra Gillespie.
Thank you.
So, Andra, the polls have closed an hour ago. Obviously, there's an expectation this could go well into the night. It seems that Mother Nature perhaps didn't help the Democrats. I understand it rained heavily in DeKalb County, the more Democratic part of the state. It may have depressed turnout. What are the atmospherics?
It did rain today, and I've only been in DeKalb County today because that happens to be where I live and work. Right now, the race is neck and neck, so the only county that's reporting results right now is Fulton County, which is where Karen Handel is based, and right now she has a slight lead over John Ossoff. So right now, the race is actually hewing to what the polls told us we should expect to see. So we expect that this race is likely to be close, and it's way too close to call. I am familiar with the arguments and the empirical evidence about how rain can dampen turnout. And one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that there was record-breaking early voter turnout in this election. So through last Saturday, 142,000 people had already cast their ballots via early voting or mail-in. So the number of people who needed to actually come out to vote today was actually smaller than we would typically think about in previous elections because people have gotten used to the idea of casting their ballots early.
So could you make something from the fact that Fulton County, which is the stronghold of Karen Handel, the Republican who I believe is even more conservative than her district, is that the fact that she's not winning by a lot in her own safe area, does that say anything?
Not yet. I mean, it's too early to report. So it's only a partial report from districts, so we don't know for sure exactly what the breakdown of the vote is, and they're not breaking it down by precinct yet on the Secretary of State's website. It's only noting that Fulton County is partially reporting, so it's way too early to speculate.
So what about the contention that has been sort of floating around ever since the primary that took place a while back. And that's the last time we spoke, Andra. And as you recall, it was a very close nail biter, just like this one is, but for different reasons. Ossoff had to get to the 50% threshold to win outright and not have to go through this subsequent election that's on today. And he fell just fell short. So is there anything to the idea that the African-American vote didn't show up that time in the numbers that were necessary, and that cost him an outright win, and that this would be a critical factor in today's election?
Well, every vote counts in this district, which is why both candidates are looking to their bases and looking to critical swing groups. African-Americans as a whole make up about 13% of this district. And historically, their turnout in this district has not been proportional to their numbers in the population. So in that respect, the fact that African Americans didn't comprise 13% of the electorate in the April election wasn't a surprise. Based on estimates from people who have access to voter rolls and then can match that to voter records, it looks like African Americans are making up about 10% of the electorate this time around, which is, again, less than what their proportion is in the population. But that's not terribly unusual given historic voting patterns in the district. So I think, you know, while somebody could argue, given the narrow margin in this race, oh, if you just went to this group more or that group more, that might actually make the difference in the election. I think it's also important to keep in mind that you shouldn't put expectations on groups that don't necessarily hew to what prior voting behavior would suggest that it is. So the critical group in this election that I think a lot of people are going to be looking at are white women, particularly college-educated white women, some of whom do identify as being Republican, but maybe are dissatisfied with the Trump administration, or maybe could have been persuaded by John Ossoff's message related to women's health, particularly breast cancer, and Susan and Karen Handel's role in the Susan G. Komen Foundation decision to defund Planned Parenthood for a little while earlier this decade. You know, at the same time, I think largely when we look back at this race, what we're going to see is that partisanship is a big predictor of the vote. So in that respect, I expect Democrats to vote for Ossoff. I expect Republicans to vote for Karen Handel. And this comes down to GOTV. And we've got to give John Ossoff credit. He tried to find every Democrat that lived in this district. Based on polling from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, he actually was campaigned, personally contacted via canvassing or phone banking, more than half of the voters in the district. So regardless of whether or not they win or lose, they are to be commended for actually personally reaching out to as many voters as they possibly could.
And again, I'm speaking with Andra Gillespie, a professor of political science at Emory University, who before joining the faculty at Emory worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman. She's the author of the new Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark and the Post-Racial America, and served as a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Now, in terms of a television ad, there was this very scurrilous, little-known conservative group bought some time on the Fox News outlet there in Atlanta over the weekend with an ad showing emergency crews carrying victims of the attacks of the Republican congressmen practicing at the baseball game in Virginia the other day. And the moderator voiceover intoned, "The same unhinged leftist cheering last week's shooting are all backing John Ossoff. And if he wins, they win." I mean, that's pretty below the belt, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And both candidates condemned the ad. And even when a GOP party chair from an adjacent district praised the ad or predicted that shooting would actually help Karen Handel, he was roundly criticized and then had to apologize and take back those comments. They were really unfortunate. I think, you know, it is a reflection of the polarization and the lack of civility in our culture that the shooting and these incidents remind us that we all need to be mindful against. At the end of the day, the most people had made up their mind about who they were going to support before this ad hit the airwaves. So in that respect, I guess one can be thankful for the fact that there was early voting if you were a Karen Handel supporter, because many of her supporters likely would have already cast their votes. So if there was any uncertainty for Ossoff voters, you know, as a result of the incident, which I doubt that there was, chances are they've already made up their mind and they weren't going to be dissuaded from that because of that ad if they saw it.
So how much has been made of the fact that John Ossoff lives about a mile or so out of the district because his girlfriend is studying medicine at Emory University and he's supporting her, but he grew up in the district he's running in. So have the Republicans been able to make an issue out of that?
Karen Handel has certainly tried, so she constantly refers to him as an outsider. So she's using the combination of his living outside the district, using his policy views, which she argues are ideologically incongruent with voters in the district. And then she also uses his fundraising haul, and in particular that he got a lot of donations from California. So they talk about the Hollywood donations, but then they also talk about the donations from San Francisco, and they routinely try to tie John Ossoff to Nancy Pelosi and indicate that he's going to be a shill for her if he's elected to Congress. So it's constantly come up as a refrain. Ossoff voters do not seem to be swayed by the data. So there was a poll about a month ago that asked the question about Ossoff's residency status. They don't think that it's an issue. For Handel voters, though, a slim majority of respondents in the survey indicated that it was a major problem for them. And about nearly a quarter of Handel voters suggested that it was a minor problem for them. So I think that, you know, if we're Monday morning quarterbacking tomorrow and Ossoff loses, that's one of the things that people are going to speculate may have been the reason for his loss, especially if it's a narrow loss.
But what accounts for the fact that he was fairly comfortably ahead of her in the polls and now it's shrunk down to about 1 point of 1%? So $56 million is spent in this most expensive race in the history of U.S. Congress. So has the money on her side, as much as she's gone after Hollywood and San Francisco money, obviously a lot of money's poured in on her side, perhaps even more. Something has made a difference in narrowing the gap, has it not?
Well, I mean, so there are a number of factors to keep in mind. I mean, clearly Ossoff and his supporters have raised more money than Handel has. But there are a couple of things to think about. One, the April election was what we call a blanket primary. So it was just like the primaries that you have in California. It's an open primary where anybody can run, and whoever the top two vote getters were going to move to the second round. It could have been two Democrats. It could have been two Republicans. The Democrats very quickly consolidated around John Ossoff as a candidate. There was a state senator in particular named Ron Slotin, who some people thought because of his prior experience might have been a viable candidate. But once John Ossoff got some key endorsements from Congressman Hank Johnson and John Lewis, it became very clear that the Democrats were going to consolidate around this one candidate. And that coalescence actually allowed Ossoff to take the lead. Because of the numbers in the district and that this district is a Republican-leaning district, it was never really predicted that he was going to get 50% plus one on the first ballot. And so it wasn't surprising that this went to a runoff. On the Republican side, you had about a dozen Republicans who were running for office, and so the Republican vote was naturally going to split amongst them. And so once Handel was the Republican with the plurality of votes, then it was her job to consolidate that Republican vote. I think an important thing to keep in mind, especially not knowing yet what the final outcome of this election is going to be, if you take Ossoff's percentage, he gets a little over 48% of the vote, and then you add up the votes for all of the remaining Democratic candidates and the two independent candidates who were liberal-leaning in their points of view, that still was less than 50%. So Ossoff was going to have to do more to not just win over those voters who voted for other left-leaning candidates, but he was also going to have to find more voters and actually bring them to the polls.
Well, Andra Gillespie, I thank you for joining us. I guess you're going to be up there for a few more hours, right?
Yeah,
we're not going to know anything until quite late. Well, thank you for insight, and I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Andra Gillespie, who is a professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman and is the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. And she served as a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether an accidental war between the U.S. and Russia could break out in Syria.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And it looks as though there could be a possibility of an accidental war breaking out between the U.S. and Russia, although it perhaps is quite remote. But, you know, history is full of accidental wars, as we know. So let's just start with the latest incidents. It looks as though the U.S. has shot down two Iranian drones, and one a while back that they just announced, and one more recently. And then on Sunday, the U.S. downed a Syrian warplane, an Su-22 fighter bomber, and that's really angered the Russians. And now they've announced that any U.S.-led coalition warplane flying west of the river Euphrates would be tracked by Russian anti-aircraft forces and treated as targets. So I guess they'd lock on. Whether they'd fire missiles is another matter. But how do you see this escalation, Nicholas?
Ian, I believe my assessment is that at this stage, the United States and Russia are not interested in a great power confrontation over Syria. However, what is dangerous is that the Assad government and its Iranian and Iranian proxy allies are actively trying to contest and to roll back the gains of the local Syrian partners of the U.S.-led coalition, because Assad fears that the Trump administration will decide that the territory that has been taken from ISIS as a part of the counter-ISIS campaign should be held by U.S. partner forces, and to try to force a dynamic where Assad would have to come to the negotiating table seriously and may not ever be able to reclaim all of the country. And if Assad can't reclaim all of the country, then that then opens up the possibility of internal discord and revolt against his rule in his state in Western Syria. So for Assad and Iran, the stakes right now in Eastern Syria are high. And for Russia, the stakes aren't quite as high. So in this current phase, I see a lot more U.S.-Russian engagement than the current public rhetoric would suggest. Where I am most concerned is what will be Iran and Assad's play as we move forward.
And what's disputed here, I take it, is the Euphrates Valley, and also there's some very valuable oil fields, are there not?
Yes. Fundamentally, Assad is most interested in the oil resources in the lower Euphrates River Valley region, in and around the city of Deir al-Zor, which is near the Syrian-Iraqi border. That area is currently held by ISIS, and it is now ISIS's sort of new caliphate capital, as Mosul has fallen and as Raqqa has fallen. But also what's significant out there in eastern Syria, and where we begin to see the contestation, is that the U.S. Backed local Syrian partner forces control an important and strategic town called Tabqa. And there's a dam there, the Thawra Dam, which is very important for electricity production in western Syria. In years past, it has produced a significant portion of electricity that went to western Syria, the major cities of the country. It fell to ISIS, was and is now under the control of U.S.-backed partner forces. So the area around Raqqa, although there are not oil resources, is strategic because the location would allow Assad to sort of stage a campaign to reconquer eastern Syria. And there are also resources in that area that are important for Assad to continue to run his economy. So as we start to look out east and we look at sort of this sort of race between the U.S.-led coalition and Assad and his allies to be there, to be in at the death of ISIS in the lower Euphrates River Valley by the Syrian-Iraqi border, that is where we are likely to see the most tension and conflict between Assad and his partners and local Syrian partners, the United States. And the danger is, Ian, is that because you have U.S. and other coalition state partner special forces that are embedded with several of the local Syrian partners in the area, in eastern Syria, you could have inadvertent U.S. or partner casualties that could lead to a larger issue.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. So far, the U.S. military have shot down two of these Iranian Shahed 129 drones, which are capable of carrying bombs and missiles, one Tuesday and another about a month ago. And as I mentioned, the U.S. Air Force shot down a Syrian Su-22 fighter bomber that had been bombing near where the U.S. allied forces are, ensconced along with, I believe, special forces as well. Now, the Australian Air Force has withdrawn its F-18 Super Hornets from the coalition strikes because of the Russian threats. But at this point, what's the attitude of the U.S.-led coalition in the air? I mean, are they going to just basically accept the Russian demarcation? And what happens if they get locked on, which is what the Russians are saying they'll do if they stray into the West?
So, one of the unspoken dynamics that has occurred between the United States and Russia, well, since Russia's military intervention in Syria in September 2015, is that, you know, from time to time, the Russians or the Assad regime will, quote unquote, paint U.S. Air Force assets or other coalition partner assets with radar, with anti-air missile radar, as a way to try to intimidate, or the Russians from time to time will fly their jets very close to U.S. jets. I mean, there have been sort of periodic incidents where either the Russians will decide that they don't like where U.S. forces are operating, or they want to send a signal to the U.S. that the U.S. and its coalition partners are inside the territory of Syria, because the still technically sovereign government of Syria, that which is led by Bashar al-Assad, allows them to be there. And I think this is a very important dynamic, Ian. You know, from the Russian perspective, from Russia's perspective, and from Iran's perspective, they are on a legitimate foreign internal defense mission to support an ally against a terrorist insurgency. That's how they view it. And they view all armed groups that are not either with the Syrian army that's under the control of Bashar al-Assad's government, or sort of ancillary forces that support the Syrian army that supports Bashar al-Assad's government, as enemy combatants. And so this is where it becomes very difficult for U.S. policy, where the Trump team really should articulate what is their Syria policy. Right now, the White House is in the process of Syria review. They haven't yet communicated, what it is they intend to do with the counter-ISIS campaign, and what they intend to do with sort of the broader dynamic of how to wind down the Syrian civil war. President Trump has indicated that he will hold a press conference on this topic, perhaps as early as next week. What is his vision, or his administration's vision, the counter-ISIS campaign? And it's important because, right now, the fact of the matter is the U.S.-led coalition, U.S. forces, and ally and partner nation forces are working with local Syrian partner forces to take the fight to ISIS. they're conquering and holding territory from ISIS, and you have the groundwork for an American military mandate over perhaps 40% of Syria's landmass, most of which would be in eastern and northern Syria. And what is done with that territory, how it is stabilized, and, you know, what exactly is the Trump team's plan for it will have tremendous importance, not only in the future of Syria, but in the future of the wider Middle East. And until we hear a clear Syria plan, a clear pathway for what to do with the success of the counter-ISIS campaign, you know, there will continue to be these sort of provocations from the Assad, predominantly from the Assad government, towards U.S.-led coalition that can then escalate.
And, of course, the Russian deputy foreign minister has accused the U.S. of open collusion with terrorists. But you're not too worried about the U.S. And Russia getting into a collision here. The people who are pushing the envelope, as you just pointed out, Nicholas Harris, are the Syrians and the Iranians. Now, the Iranians have sent columns of Hezbollah, I believe, although most of their IRGC recruits are recruited from, I believe, Lebanese Shia, Iraqi Shia, etc., even Yemeni Shia. But they're not sending in there too many of their own people. I don't know whether the Quds are in there. But my understanding is what the Iranians want, along with Bashar al-Assad, is they want a corridor from whatever's left of Syria that Assad controls on the coast, through Syria, through Iraq, into Iran. Is that the real subtext here for the Iranians?
So that is one dynamic that is of concern. Though we should recognize that the Iranians can fly most everything that they would like to give Hezbollah via air, landed in Damascus International Airport or other Assad-controlled military airports in western Syria. The fact that Assad has a territorial statelet centered in western Syria that is contiguous with Hezbollah-controlled areas of Lebanon provides tremendous strategic depth for Hezbollah, and Hezbollah provides Iran with the ability to have a strategic deterrence aimed at Israel. The land corridor or land bridge, as it's also called, is one dynamic. And yes, it is possible that the Iranians could use that land corridor to perhaps ship heavier grade missiles. Although we should acknowledge that the Israelis have shown the capability to conduct airstrikes, to identify weapons that they're uncomfortable with being transferred from Iran via Syria, presumably to Lebanon, and have conducted airstrikes. So this year, the Israelis conducted an airstrike in Palmyra, which is in central, southern, eastern Syria, and it's under control of the Assad government. And in the past, they've conducted airstrikes in the region of Deir al-Zor, right near the border between Syria and Iraq. So I tend to think that the major issue that's at play here is that Syria does not have one unitary state government actor. Syria has divided zones of control, and the U.S.-led coalition is gaining a larger zone of control, and that the Assad government would like to reclaim all of Syria over time. It sees an opportunity as ISIS weakens, and it's trying to outposition the U.S.-led coalition. And it realizes that Syria, the geographic space that is a Syria monopoly board is rapidly being filled up. And if Assad and his partners don't fill up that space in the east, they could invite a U.S.-led military mandate that would prevent and would frustrate Assad from being able to continue to be, you know, the one ruler of Syria. And that is a threat, an existential threat to his regime.
And we don't know what the U.S. policy is. As you pointed out, the Trump administration has not made it clear what its policy is, and it's delegated it mostly to the U.S. military. So what's your sense of what can fill the vacuum there if the U.S. decides to occupy, or the coalition as it's called, occupy all this territory in eastern Syria? Their strongest asset, of course, are the Syrian Kurds, the people that they were protecting, that they shot the Syrian jet down. I don't know what part of what's left of the pro-Western Syrian forces. I don't believe there's too much of them left. So if you wipe out the Islamic State, what happens to these other al-Qaeda-affiliated, al-Nusra people? Are they still roaming around? I mean, what kind of occupation could the U.S. put together to cover all this vast territory in the east, which is very thinly populated?
The dynamics are different in which section of eastern Syria we discuss. In northeastern Syria, where you already have the northern Syria federal region, which was established by local U.S. partners, there's already sort of a dynamic in place of anticipation for a sort of longer U.S. military presence there. In this core sort of ISIS-held area in the lower Euphrates River Valley, south of Raqqa, all the way down the Euphrates River to the Syrian-Iraqi border, the local population is predominantly Sunni Arab tribes. And the Kurdish majority forces within the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition that's taken the fight to ISIS will be unliked occupiers of that territory. Right now, the U.S.-led coalition is trying to build up partner Arab forces to fight and to conquer that area of the lower Euphrates River Valley. But the fact of the matter is, whether it's Assad and his allies or it's the U.S.-led coalition, the most likely local hold and security force in the lower Euphrates River Valley and areas that have yet to be conquered from ISIS will in fact be local Syrian Sunni Arab tribal militias that had risen in revolt against Assad back in late 2011, 2012, and parts of 2013, had pushed Assad out of that area for the most part, and then were unable to fight back against ISIS. And so right now, the hold force that will be required, that will be relied on for the security of that area to prevent ISIS or al-Qaeda from emerging there, are in fact subordinate to ISIS. They're tribal militias that are subordinate to ISIS. And that's one of the major challenges when we look forward to what we could call phase four, or the stabilization component of the post-ISIS campaign, is that so much of the local Syrian partner hold force were beat by ISIS or subordinate to ISIS, and will have to reacclimate themselves to sort of rule by proxy by a U.S.-led coalition that until recently were considered their enemies.
And presumably, once this is all over, if indeed this is the end game that we're witnessing, at least the beginning of the end game, the Syrian government, the Assad side, will of course build up their forces with Iranian and Russian help. So none of this looks as though this thing's ever going to end, does it?
It's a very difficult dynamic, Ian, and there's a tremendous sort of tug of war that's going on in this in positioning and pulling as the campaign against ISIS in Mosul and northern Iraq winds down. Those Iraqi Shia militias that you referred to earlier in our discussion, that are the ones that are backed by Iran, are increasingly looking to fight with Assad in Syria. Because from their perspective, from the perspective of these Iraqi Shia militias, Iraq's national security is dependent on the defeat of ISIS in that Syrian desert, Syrian-Iraqi border region. So from their perspective, by supporting Assad, they're supporting the sovereign government of Syria, and they're returning security to the border region. The problem is that they will need tens of thousands of those Shia militia fighters, and they will need them, this is Assad, will need them to help his local forces hold terrain, and then over time sort of coerce local tribal militias that are Sunni Arab to accept the new normal of Assad's returned rule. And Assad and his allies will face difficulties, similar difficulties and perhaps even more magnified than that of the U.S.-led coalition. And for the U.S.-led coalition, the question is how long does the Trump team actually want to be in Syria? Most of these local Syrian partner forces are taking a leap of faith that the U.S. is going to commit itself to some sort of residual military presence in Syria. It may not be tens of thousands of U.S. forces on the ground. It might be a couple thousand spread out among several forward operating bases with some other coalition partners, perhaps from the Gulf Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia. But fundamentally, there is no stabilization mission that that evolves from the current counter-ISIS campaign that doesn't have at least a few thousand U.S. troops on the ground. And so it's up to the Trump team to make the calculation both politically and practically of whether it wants to commit to that.
But just in the last minute, it seems that there's an inherent contradiction, and there has been all along, where the U.S. are supporting in Iraq, they're supporting Shia militias, and in Syria, they're supporting Sunni militias, and that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it? Or at least for problems to come.
It creates a constant devil's dilemma of who has what authority and who has what legitimacy. And fundamentally, when you look at those areas that are still under ISIS's control or that are just recently freed from ISIS, legitimacy cannot be imposed from far away. Legitimacy will have to be built on the local level. And whichever sort of larger power, whether it's Assad and his friends or the U.S.-led coalition, that is able to get more local support will be better positioned.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how not just the Russians, but other foreign countries influence our elections.
يا ويلي الثوب الاسود يا ويلي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Marshall, an award-winning journalist and researcher who is the author and co-author of five books on international relations and modern history, including the Iran-Contra Connection, Secret Teams and Covert Operations in the Reagan Era, and The Lebanese Connection, Corruption, Civil War, and the International Drug Traffic. He has a five-part series of articles on foreign lobbying at Consortium News, the latest of which is Saudis Win Hearts by Lining Pockets. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Marshall.
Thank you very much.
And obviously there's a lot of focus on possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Trump administration and Russia, and that's been dominating the news and will continue to. But your feeling is that there's a broader issue here, I take it, of how foreign money influences our politics, has been doing so for a long time and continues to do so.
That's right. I was thinking of the irony that this country spends over $600 billion a year on the military to defend ourselves and our national sovereignty. We spend a heck of a lot less defending our kind of cyber security. So we've seen that many institutions, ranging from the Clinton campaign to Sony Pictures, have been attacked by such intrusions. And thus we have questions about the integrity of the 2016 campaign and of our whole democratic process. But even worse is that we do almost nothing to protect ourselves from the influence of foreign money on our national politics. We have a rather pathetic law called the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which has almost never been really enforced. It's supposed to keep tabs on foreign money and the lobbyists in the United States who take that money to try to influence Congress and public opinion. But these lobbies can be very potent, can have a big effect on our policy, and we're doing almost nothing to track and control their operations.
Well, I suppose, though, just to continue the comparison to the Russian story and particularly, for example, the Saudis that you've written about in your latest of this five-part series on foreign lobbying at Consortium News, Saudis win hearts by lining pockets. We know about APAC, of course, the Israel lobby and its influence. The Saudis have been spending a lot of money for a long time, and other countries, and now with Trump, because of his problems with the emoluments clause of the Constitution, there's growing evidence that his foreign policy may almost entirely be influenced by which countries he has hotel deals with, like the Saudis. He has a great deal with them. He has a bad deal with the Qataris, who happen to be the victims now of Saudi foreign policy. He has dealings in the Philippines, which may be why he was so nice to that murderous leader there. And he also has dealings with Erdogan's Turkey, involving some of Erdogan's cronies. And, of course, he was the first to congratulate Erdogan for this recent referendum that was largely stolen, and which no other European country wanted to acknowledge. So,
and don't forget his 180-degree turnaround on China, which he went from blasting in the strongest of terms as a currency manipulator, an unfair trader, and threat to the United States. Now he has a love affair with the Chinese regime, which just happened to coincide with them granting his trademark and copyright requests and opening lots of doors to his business interests. Really, it almost puts his alleged Russian connections to shame.
So I suppose you could say we've always had a government for sale for foreign buyers, and now we have a government for sale and a president for sale. But just to touch on the Russian thing, I don't think we've ever had a foreign country interfere with our elections, not just money. I don't know how much money was spent, very little as far as I can tell, except, you know, for the Russian oligarchs who've been funding Trump since Wall Street blackballed him. But that's another issue. But no other foreign power has unleashed its intelligence services and thousands of troll farms full of paid hackers that work for Russian intelligence. That's a whole other ballgame, isn't it?
It certainly, if these allegations are true, and I think we should concede that they're as yet unproven, but...
What's unproven? That they hacked the elections? They hacked the DNC and Podesta, etc.?
There is no publicly available evidence that proves to my mind that the Russian government was behind the hacking of the Clinton campaign. Someone hacked their emails, or at least disclosed them. The Democrats hired a private security firm which concluded that the Russians were behind it. But the details have not been released to the public to really give us confidence in that finding. So basically, you have to either choose to believe the assertions of U.S. intelligence leaders or decide to wait for the evidence. But the evidence really isn't public yet. So I'm somewhat agnostic. I don't dismiss it by any means, but I'm waiting for the evidence to come in. But let's assume for the moment that the Russians were behind it. That would be a first, but I'm not sure it would be true to say that no other foreign government has intervened in an American election. Certainly, the Israeli government, for example, for many years has had a strong interest in electoral outcomes. And its supporters in the United States who've been in very close communication with the Israeli government have, over the years, starting with the Truman administration, made their campaign contributions and other political support often decisively based on presidential promises to Israel. And I think that may have helped swing President Truman's decision to recognize Israel in 1948, for example, when he faced an extremely close election for the presidency. So I think historians might quibble with the idea that this is the first intervention, but it's certainly the first cyber intervention of its kind that we know of.
Right. That was more or less what I was suggesting, is that with a foreign intelligence service, particularly one that as sophisticated as the Russian one, obviously, the Israelis have always had AIPAC and had enormous influence, largely through the Democratic Party, but now they're even more so through the Republican Party, through the so-called Christian Zionist movement. And it was no secret, for example, that Netanyahu supported Romney against Barack Obama. It was pretty overt. So,
and then quite overt that he supported Trump over Obama.
Right. Well, let's pick up that again, because you mentioned it'd be Trump over Hillary, wouldn't it?
Yes, I'm sorry. First, he was supporting Netanyahu over Obama in terms of the controversy over the Iran nuclear deal, which, ironically, many, if not most, top Israeli security officials supported, albeit somewhat reluctantly, because they realized that curbing a potential nuclear program by Iran was in Iran's security, in Israel's security interests. Netanyahu, however, was much more militant, really wanting the Obama administration to all but go to war with Iran to serve Israeli, his vision of Israeli interests. We need to have a distinction between Israeli interests, which are a matter of opinion and many people would disagree over what they are, and Netanyahu's vision of them, which were very hardline indeed. Following Netanyahu's failure to overturn Obama's deal with Iran, he then quite clearly threw his support to Trump over Clinton. Clinton had been an ardent supporter of Israel, promised to meet with Netanyahu in her first month in office. She was supported by an Israeli-American billionaire. She was a very strong supporter of Israel, but Netanyahu wanted an even more right-wing supporter, and he pretty clearly threw his weight behind Trump to the point where Trump was getting a huge ovation in his speech to AIPAC, which was actually quite a violation of AIPAC's protocol, which was to be nonpartisan.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Marshall, an award-winning journalist and researcher who is author or co-author of 5 books on international relations and modern history, including the Iran-Contra connection, secret teams and covert operations in the Reagan era, and the Lebanese connections, corruption, civil war, and the international drug traffics. He has a 5-part series of articles on foreign lobbying at Consortium News, the latest of which is Saudis Win Hearts by Lining Pockets. And of course, Donald Trump's son-in-law is now in Israel making a peace deal. He's going to solve this intractable Gordian knot of Israel-Palestinian peace. And, of course, Netanyahu, when Jared Kushner was growing up, he would have to cede his bedroom to Netanyahu, who was a regular house guest of his parents. So there's a tighter connection, that I think, even than Trump, through Trump's son-in-law to Netanyahu. But let's turn to the Saudis, because I think the Israeli situation is fairly well known. I don't know that they spend a lot of money. They just have a lot of political influence.
Well, Israel, unlike the other lobbies, probably does not spend a huge amount of money. What makes the Israel lobby so powerful is that its U.S. supporters spend a lot of money. They are, as you, I think, intimated earlier, a huge disproportionate source of funding for the Democratic Party and a very rapidly growing and large source of funding for the Republican Party, which makes it a very, very potent lobby indeed.
But it seems that the difference with the Saudis, from what I understand, is that the Saudis actually spend money on executive branch connections. They get top officials in the State Department, the Defense Department, and the intelligence services almost through a revolving door. And they also spend an awful lot of money on lobbying through Podesta's brother. We were talking about the hack against Podesta running the Hillary campaign. His brother, of course, has been one of the biggest recipients of Saudi money lobbying. And of course, in your article, you quote my friend, the former CIA officer Bob Baer, about the influence of Saudi money during the Bush and Clinton era, saying, quoting Bob, finding a high-ranking former U.S. official who isn't at least tangentially bound to Saudi Arabia is like searching for a teetotaler at a Phi Gamma Toga party. So there you have it.
Their strategy is rather simple and crude. Just throw money at almost everyone and see what sticks. They'll pump money into investment funds that politicians are involved with. They'll pump money into universities that will reflect on a politician. The Clinton Foundation, of course, got millions and millions of dollars. They are, in one of their big lobbying campaigns, they just spent over $250,000 at Trump's hotel in Washington. Of all the hotel choices, of course, they spent it there. You alluded to their hotel deals. One of their hotel deals basically saved Trump from total business ruin some years ago. And so, yes, by just and now they're spending well over $1 million a month on high-priced lobbying firms with connections like the Podesta Group, big, big-time connections with the Democratic Party, but also firms that are deeply connected to the Republican Party. So they cover all their bases and throw money at the problem.
So let's go back to Citizens United. And you recall shortly after Citizens United came down from the Supreme Court, at the State of the Union, President Obama talked about the danger of Citizens United, the unaccounted money flowing in to political campaigns, and he mentioned flowing in also from foreign sources, at which one of these right-wing Tea Party Republicans got up and said, "You lie." And also the Supreme Court Justice who was sitting there, Alito, mouthed, "Not true." But it is true. These dark money vehicles that have been set up, these 501c4 so-called social welfare funds, there's nothing to stop foreign entities from pouring money into our campaigns as it is from the Koch brothers, is it?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not an expert on this. That certainly the law would still bar foreign entities from directly funding political campaigns. But foreign money can fund issue campaigns, which, of course, are in today's world very difficult to distinguish from political campaigns. And it's the reason many of these entities continue to get tax exemption from the IRS, which has become completely toothless. So you may be right. I haven't seen many documented instances of large-scale funding of these dark money vehicles that are clearly going to a specific campaign, but that may be, in fact, a growing problem.
Well, I can't see what would stop Tony Podesta from setting up a 501c4 through his firm and calling it the Fund for American Democracy and having the Saudi money pour through and, you know, funnel it to whoever the Saudis wanted to support. I can't see
how... I don't believe that they could send it directly to support a candidate. But they could, yeah. But they could, for example, go into a congressional district and say, America needs all the allies it can get in the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia has been one of its staunchest allies, and isn't it too bad that Congressman X doesn't see the importance to American security of supporting, you know, America's Gulf state allies, including Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. So through such thin veils, one may indeed see that. I think probably foreign governments are being careful not to overstep because that kind of thing could bring a huge backlash, even if it was temporarily viewed as legal. But I think in principle, you're right that that is a serious danger of the kind of freewheeling political situation we're in these days.
Well, but let's just look at, in the last couple of minutes here, let's look at the kind of Saudi money that was thrown at the Congress when they watered down, they tried to stop the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act that came out of 9/11, pushed by the 9/11 families. And they spent an awful lot of money, didn't they, the Saudis, through Congress? And they lost that battle.
Right, but we should be careful. They weren't pumping money into specific congressional campaigns. What they were doing, though, which is why it's so important that we have greater transparency and regulation of what goes on, they were, for example, recruiting veterans, U.S. Military veterans, under questionable pretenses, flying them all expenses paid, putting them up in suites at the Trump Hotel, which of course endeared them to the president, and then sending them into the halls of Congress to lobby against the legislation that Saudi Arabia was trying to overturn. So if you're a member of Congress, it's not that this money, that you're now getting Saudi money to spend as you want, but you are getting a strong impression that your constituents, including veterans who probably who could be quoted on local TV and radio stations and either help or hurt you because of their credibility, these veterans are swarming your offices telling you how to vote. And most members of Congress are going to take that kind of thing very seriously. How much money Saudi Arabia has to pump into a campaign like that, they're going to be loath to cross Saudi interests.
Well, just in closing, Jonathan Marshall, what can be done here? This is really the for sale sign up is on the entire U.S. government. And as the former head of the FBI was railing against the Russians in his testimony, saying, you know, it's, you know, we have very vigorous debates in this country, but the idea of foreign government deciding who gets elected in America, that's just beyond the pale. So his indignation should be nationwide, but it should be broader than just the Russians. It's, this is business as usual. That's...
I think we need to first broaden our inquiry much beyond the Russians. Secondly, we need to, with the First Amendment, we have to be careful about just banning money spent on political crusades that we may not like. But we can, at a minimum, demand full disclosure of where the money is coming from and what ends it's being put to. And I think the, once we need absolutely need that disclosure, and then we absolutely need the media to keep reminding us of where the money is coming from and where it's going. We see today the media frequently running opinion columns in the pages of the Washington Post and elsewhere that are coming from entities that are funded by foreign governments without any disclosure. And that's unconscionable. We need much better job from the media about telling us where this money is coming from, and a much better job from the Justice Department, and a much better job from Congress about demanding full disclosure and transparency.
Well, Jonathan Marshall, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Marshall, who's an award-winning journalist and researcher, who's the author, co-author of 5 books on international relations and modern history, including The Iran-Contra Connection, Secret Teams and Covert Operations in the Reagan Era, and The Lebanese Connection, Corruption, Civil War, and the International Drug Traffic. He has a 5-part series of articles on foreign lobbying at Consortium News, the latest of which is Saudis Win Hearts by Lining Pockets. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.